This is a Federal News Network podcast.
From infant formula to the devastating war in Ukraine, nothing is too big or small for congressional attention this week. You can throw veterans and veterans affairs into the mix. We get the outlook from Bloomberg Government Deputy News Director Lauren Duggan. And it sounds like whatever the blame or cause or supply chain, this infant formula issue is really getting to Congress, which in turn is looking at what agencies might have a role in either causing it or fixing it.
That's right. This is a problem that's happening nationwide, and that inevitably filters up to Congress and the lawmakers who hear from each other and hear from their constituents. So what we'll see this week is a hearing at the House Appropriations Committee where the FDA commissioner is going to testify. Obviously, they play a key role in regulating things like baby formula and food in the country. So I'm sure there will be a number of questions for that agency. And it's the first of many hearings that I think we're likely to see over the coming weeks. And things we're going to hear from lawmakers who are concerned about this, because it is having a real world impact as you see pictures of empty shelves, or at least somewhat empty shelves, and people looking far and wide to get the particular formula that their baby may need. So this is going to be, I think, a lingering issue, probably one that's top of mind, because it is, it has a salience. It has, I think, an emotional resonance as well that is something that Congress will continue to pay attention to.
And veterans, once again, occupying some parts of Congress this week.
That's right. The House is out next week for just a committee work week, and they traditionally take up a slate of bills to help with things like veterans benefits, whether it's education or healthcare or different things that the VA provides to people who have served this country in war. There's a slate of those headed to the House floor this week. Mostly will be bipartisan, probably passed with some wide margins, bills that have moved through the House Veterans Affairs Committee, and in some cases even already have Senate companions or been endorsed by the Senate. So this is a pretty traditional thing to do right around Memorial Day, and they're continuing that tradition this year.
All right. And there is some contention over, I guess, the vote, whatever vote they were going to have with respect to Roe versus Wade is over. Is Congress further involved at this point because the Supreme Court is under almost lock and key? Certainly they're surrounded by fencing and so forth. Is, aside from the political rhetoric, any connection at this point?
I think rhetoric will definitely continue. Democrats are going to continue pushing and hoping that maybe there's a way to persuade their neighbors across the street to not go forward with the draft opinion, or maybe try to change things there. Depending on how final that opinion is, it was drafted at this stage and will probably be released in a final form sometime in the coming months. There could be more action in Congress on this, whether they force people to vote on the same issue over and over again, which is not unprecedented, or look for other ways to go after this, whether it's other programs to help people around the country that they think would be negatively affected by this ruling. But a lot of this is going to shift to states. And I think that's where you're going to see even more legislative action, with even some states considering special sessions to come in. And perhaps now that Roe v. Wade would be struck down, if that draft opinion were to become the law of the land, they would maybe pass some additional legislation in their states. So there will be a lot of talk. I think you'll have more hearings, and I think you'll have more votes on this issue in the coming months. It's not over. Even once the decision is signed, this is going to remain an issue, because I think it's factoring into people's thinking about the midterms, and therefore you use what you have in Congress to kind of add to that discussion.
And all of this takes duty cycle time away from, say, the 2023 budget, which had a little momentum a couple weeks ago.
That's right, where the big four, or the four corners, if you will, the leaders of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees have started their discussions about trying to come to top line spending on the defense and the non-defense side with that agreement in place. So it would make it a lot easier to make progress on appropriations bills and defense authorization as well. Always easier when you have a shared number for that. We haven't heard much about the progress there. A lot of the appropriations time last week was taken up by the Ukraine supplemental, but there's still work to be done there to try and move forward. There are aspirations to start marking up those appropriations bills in June and start moving them toward the floor, at least on the House side, trying to get some progress going there. So I think those talks aren't by any means over. I think they might need a little bit of a reboot, but that is still a priority, is to make some progress on that. The cabinet officials keep making the rounds on Capitol Hill to defend what they asked for. So that part of the process is going, but we'll see what happens next.
We're speaking with Lauren Duggan, Deputy News Director at Bloomberg Government. And the Ukraine bill, that was stalled by certain language that Rand Paul wanted, $40 billion, which from the sound of it could help Ukraine actually nail Russia. And what's the status of that now?
We'll see a procedural vote tonight in the Senate trying to push that forward. The hope that Senate Democrats and Republicans as well, and for the most part, had was that they could come to an agreement to clear this thing last week, to push it through quickly, get it to President Biden so he could sign it and that this aid could start flowing. Because of the way the Senate works and one senator can hold up unanimous consent, which Senator Rand Paul did, they're having to go through some hoops to move that forward. They had hoped that he would accept just a vote on the language that he wants to insert some oversight functions into the bill, but he was actually demanded that it be added to the bill, and Republicans and Democrats weren't willing to agree to that. So we're sort of in this standstill. We'll see how quickly the bill can move, if tonight's procedural vote opens the gates to this happening quickly, or if they have to burn up a lot of floor time trying to get that over the line in the coming days.
And there's also the possibility of a few appointments coming through in the Senate.
Absolutely. As we've seen, these can take a while or they can happen pretty quickly once there's agreement. Last week was a pretty banner week for some top nominations, including to the Federal Reserve, to the Federal Trade Commission, and some other positions like that. We know that this week there's already some steps taken to set up some more judicial votes. There's also the Kathy Ann Harris nomination has sort of been waiting in the wings to be both a member and the chair of the Merit Systems Protection Board. So I would anticipate more action this week on those nominations that kind of fill gaps in the schedule when there's not a bill moving at any particular time. I think we'll see more of that both on the floor and then committees are always looking at these nominations and trying to push them forward as well.
And this all while they're not spending time issuing subpoenas to one another. Which that's got to detract from the spirit of civility that used to pervade up there.
I think it does to some extent, but that's sort of the whole January 6th committee is looking at a very unusual and perhaps unprecedented event on Capitol Hill. And some of the what's come out of that has been unprecedented as well, with contempt citations, subpoenas to co-lawmakers and things like that. So it's a very unusual time, a very unusual committee. And I think that's borne out with that.
All right. Lauren Duggan is Deputy News Director at Bloomberg Government. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Podcast One or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, I'm WIPA CEO Shane Canfield, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lessons in Leadership. I'm honored to be joined by Angie Bailey, founder and CEO of Ananda Life. Angie has a remarkable career in public service, beginning as a GS-2 clerk typist with the Social Security Administration. And over the next 40 years, Angie steadily worked her way up through the government, ultimately becoming the Chief Human Capital Officer at the Department of Homeland Security. She's been recognized with presidential rank awards by two administrations for leadership, innovation, dedication, and commitment to the country. Angie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Shane. What a pleasure to be here.
Angie, you've made quite a name for yourself as a leader in the federal workforce. Who was the first person you remember looking up to as a leader, and what about them inspired you?
You know, I often think about this because, you know, sometimes we think of the people that we look up to the most as being somebody that throughout our career has, you know, been at the highest levels and all. But, I've got to go back to, honestly, whenever I was 10 years old. And I remember I really wanted to play Little League baseball on a boys' team. I was the only girl. And interestingly, it was the women who would keep saying to me that, no, I couldn't play. And then one day, whenever I was there to sign up yet again, there was this guy, his name was Delbert Beiser. And I remember he had like red hair and he had a wad of tobacco in his mouth and greasy overalls and everything. And he said, you know, I'll take her on my team. And, you know, just looking back on that, there's so many leadership lessons and things that I just really admire about him. And actually, I thought about throughout my entire career, he took a chance on somebody he didn't know. He put aside whatever conscious or unconscious biases that he might have had about having a girl on a team. He treated me the same. If I wasn't performing, I got benched just like the boys. I got no special treatment. And he was just really honest with me and he just included me in everything. And so looking back on it, you know, really, it was Delbert Beiser, our local mechanic in our little small village, that was, I think, my inspiration for going on to, I hope, become the leader, that I wanted to be.
I'd say half of the guests on this podcast have had similar stories where they reach back to either childhood or young adulthood. And I think as leaders, it's really incumbent upon us to keep that in mind, that what we say and do, especially in the younger ages, really can have a lifelong impact. How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over time?
I would say that the one word that describes my leadership style is that I care. I guess that's more than one word, but I care. I've always cared about the mission. I've always cared about the people. I've always cared, you know, about making sure that they had what they needed, or that they were developing the way, you know, that they aspired to develop. And I tried to take this approach of not treating people the way I wanted to be treated, but instead treat people the way they want to be treated. And I think that that really kind of developed over my career. You know, I started out just like most leaders do, where it's very results driven. It's all about the bottom line. You need to make sure that you get everything accomplished, because, you know, that's what everybody's looking for, the goals, the metrics, et cetera. But I think as you mature and you go along, you start to your point, you draw back on those early childhood days or early adult, young, you know, whenever you're a young adult, and you say, you know, I think that there's a little bit more to this than just the bottom line. And so over time, I really began to, I think, see a much bigger picture and the entire ecosystem, if you will, and how the people themselves fit into all of this. And that ultimately, at the end of the day, it was all about the people. And so, I think my maturity allowed me to then shift and focus more on the people than so much on results and bottom line.
You've been recognized with 2 presidential rank awards, 2 different administrations. You founded your own company. Tell us a little bit more about your background from the beginning, and how did that lead you to where you are today?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, like you said, that I started out as a GS-2 Social Security Administration. I mean, what I really wanted to be was a criminal prosecuting attorney. That was absolutely my dream. I sometimes joke and say what I really wanted to be was a mafia don, but that wasn't going to work out. So, you know, had to be a criminal prosecuting attorney. But, you know, I had to get a job to pay for college. It wasn't in the cards that I was going to be able to go to college without a job. So I applied at the at the unemployment office. And lo and behold, I got a job at Social Security. I didn't even know it was federal, to be honest. From there, I went to the Department of Defense, and I found this career field called labor and employee relations. And honestly, it was as close as I was going to get to being a criminal prosecuting attorney. I didn't go on to be a criminal prosecuting attorney, but I went on courtesy of Department of Defense to get both my bachelor's and my master's in leadership, because the whole study of leadership, I just find incredibly fascinating. You know, from historical to current times, it's just something that's just really fascinated me. And so I would say I'm a lifelong learner of leadership. And then I would say some of the other things that got me maybe where I am today is I never really said no to anything. If people asked me to take on a new challenge, even if I wasn't sure I was going to be successful at it, I would say, you know what, not sure this is going to work out, but more than happy to give it a try. And it always worked out. But I think giving things a try and just not saying no to opportunities is what really led from one position to the next. I feel like I was always rewarded for just stepping in or stepping up and taking on the challenges that sometimes no one else wanted to do.
Angie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Shane. It's such a pleasure. I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
This has been the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm CEO of WEPA, Shane Canfield. Looking forward to talking to you next time.
Grab a 30-day free trial of Live by Live Plus, and you'll get unlimited skips, commercial-free music, and all of the podcasts and live streaming events you can handle. Visit livexlive.com/podcast1 to learn more and start your free trial.